Now is that love? Pandemonium, a public affairs program with WSUT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on the show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs PA at WRCT.org. And now, Pandemonium. Hello, my name is Thomas Garrison. I'm a math major, and I'm here interviewing Wes Pegden, professor of mathematics at CMU today. And my first question is, how do you choose problems to work on?
Oh, yeah, so that's a good question. So, math problems, I think we come to them in different ways. I mean, sometimes there's a problem that people have been thinking about for decades. And it's been around for a long time that people have been curious about, and it's something that a lot of people want to solve. Other times you have a problem that you comes up in some sort of application, where it would help you solve something else, and so you start thinking about the problem that way. But a lot of times there's just problems were posed at some point and people got interested in them, and then they've been open problems for quite some time, and then it's this thing that people are interested in and understand.
Nice. Do you think about like math recreationally when you go home? Are you still thinking about math, or did it shut off?
Oh yeah, I think I think it's you spend a lot of time thinking about math. At unusual times when you're not really you're kind of always. Yeah, it's always sort of, at least in the mind, some problem that you're working for. Especially, if you're really close to something, or you feel like, or there's one little thing that you're trying to fix about some proof, then it's hard to think about anything else.
Makes sense. What is your approach when you start a new problem? How do you start, I guess?
Oh, yeah, so, I mean, that depends a lot on the problem, and also a lot on the person. Sometimes you're working in some field where where you've done a lot of work and you have a lot of tools that you're familiar with and a lot of techniques, and maybe just by the nature of the problem you have some ideas about how to get started, and there are similar problems that where you have some idea of how they were solved. And other times you're doing something completely new, and it requires you to be much more exploratory and just sort of pursue a much more open-ended process of just sort of trying to get an understanding of what's going on without really knowing where that will lead you.
And how do you decide if you like need to like pull in other people, or do you usually like to work alone, or what?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of times people decide to work together on something because they sort of encounter the problem together. They're already discussing something and then here's this thing that we've done. But other times, it can also happen that you're working on something and you think, well, this is something where I don't really know some technique or some, background that would be relevant here. Maybe so-and-so can help me with this. So I think both of those things happen. I think the social aspect of this is very real, and that sometimes just discussing things with people will lead to the idea of trying to work out some problem, and that those people will work on it together.
Got it. What's the problem you worked on that is easy to explain?
Easy to explain. One problem that's in this category of things that come from some application that people are interested in is something related to political districting, right? So there's this topic of gerrymandering, political districting. So this is when the people that draw, for example, the congressional districting of Pennsylvania might carefully draw the districting to maximize the electoral advantage they get from that districting, right? So for example, if the Republican legislature of Pennsylvania was, drawing the congressional district in 2011, they might have drawn it to try to ensure that they get as many Republican seats as possible in the U.S. Congress in a delegation. Claims of gerrymandering are often litigated, right? So there are sometimes lawsuits asserting that you know, one political party has carefully drawn a political districting to maximize their advantage in this way. Then when this happens, you know, there's a court case and evidence is presented and judges have to decide whether or not this really happened, right? Did the political party really maximize their advantage? Did they really carefully draw these lines for some political goal? And so one thing that's funny about this is, right, I mean, if you think about this in the abstract, you're presented with one map, and the question is this map fair or not? And of course, usually to think about whether something is fair, you'd want to have some comparison. And so this is where math can come into play. So in particular, the natural question that arises mathematically from this problem is how one can generate truly random partitions of a geometric shape. So for example, that geometric shape could be a state. And by a geometric partition, we mean we want to divide the shape into a certain number of regions, each of which is a connected region, and each of which, in the case of a state districting, may have to have equal population in the state, and may have to satisfy some other geometric conditions. It's an example of a sampling problem, right? I have some complicated space, which is here the ways of dividing up a geometric shape into regions, and the problem is how can I generate a random sample from this space? So that's an example of something that we've done a lot of work on. And this is a good example of a problem that really came from an application, right? So there was this thing that people were discussing, which is how can we sort of get at the problem of evaluating these districtings? And that led to these natural questions about sampling.
Nice. And for problems like gerrymandering where it's applicable to the public or problems that aren't applicable to the public, how do you try to make it like accessible to people?
Yes. Okay. In the case of the math that was related to these gerrymandering problems, it's especially important because, in particular, there's some court case, and a judge has to kind of understand what's going on because they have to, use this as part of their framework to decide what to think about. In the case of gerrymandering, for that reason, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to frame the procedure that we developed in simple terms, and even giving analogies and different ways of thinking about it, just to make it accessible. I mean, certainly, I don't think that I would never expect the proof of the theorem to be something that the court could understand, but I at least wanted the statement of the theorem to be something the court could understand,
right?
And I think that's something that we managed to do.
Less grounded in like application problem, do you still try to make it accessible, and how would you do that?
I think a lot depends on the audience for the problem. I mean, sometimes you're working on a problem that is going to really be of most interest to people working in some specialized field, and then that's your target audience, and you're really writing it for those people. And other times you're solving a problem that you hope will be more that will have wider interest, and I think you always think about who the audience is, and then you try to make what you're doing understandable and relatable to that audience. And who that audience is can be very different from one math problem to another.
That makes a lot of sense. How or when did you know you wanted to do math?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, so I think I actually, as an undergraduate, so when I started as an undergrad, I wanted to do physics. And then I switched after a year to focusing on math. So the main reason is just that I think in high school in the United States, math is generally not taught very well in most schools. It's not really something we would call mathematics even, right? I mean, if you think about the highest level math class in many schools is some sort of, AP calculus class, which is really a class about learning to do calculations. It's not really learning to do proofs or to think about things in rigorous ways that are intricate. And so I think until I got to be an undergraduate, I didn't really have a good sense of what university-level mathematics was. So I think it wasn't until I was an undergraduate that I really thought that I wanted to focus on math.
Makes sense. How has math changed the way you think?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, it's hard to know, right? I mean, I'm not sure how aware we all are our own thought, the trajectories of our own thought processes. But certainly, I think, you know, one way that we hope that math changes how we think is teaching us to be careful and cautious in our reasoning, and, you know, not make sort of unsupported leaps. There's one important lesson I think that math has to offer, which is, right, so if you're a math student at CMU, I think there should be at least one point in your class when you've seen your math professor be wrong about something.
Right.
Right. And I think this is an important lesson, right? So one thing I like about math is that there's no hiding from being wrong. And, right, a mistake is a mistake. And when something is not true, it's not true, and everybody can see it. And one thing that this should remind us of is that there is such a thing as really being wrong, and anybody can be wrong. So it suggests sort of a caution about appeals to authority, right? So just because somebody's a professor or an expert or whatever, everybody can make mistakes.
Right.
And somehow, as a student, you can see those mistakes, right? And so I think it reminds us of the power of thought, right? That you, as a thinking student, can see the professor making a mistake and can see that they made a mistake, and you can be right about that.
Right.
And somehow, so this is something that's really appealing about mathematics, is that it doesn't depend on hardly at all on appeals to the authority of the, you know, the leaders of the field, right? That any person can who has experience can sort of work through and see whether something is actually true, whether a proof is correct, whether somebody's made a mistake. So I think that there's some value in that lesson more generally, that in particular for all of us, we should remember that being wrong is a real thing.
Right.
And sometimes it's us that are wrong. Yeah.
Some of us more often than others, but,
it's a real thing, and that, you know, just being an expert on something, doesn't mean that you can't be wrong about it. And we should always remember this about ourselves.
Right. Have you ever submitted a paper and had like a big mistake pointed out to you or anything of that kind?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So after submitting a paper, I'm not sure about that. But certainly, I've written things down that I thought were right, and then later, you know, realized I had some problem with.
Yeah.
So thinking of good examples right now, but definitely this is something that happens, and it happens to everybody.
Right. What are you working on now? Is there a problem that you can explain in not too long?
Okay, well, one thing I can do is I can explain sort of in more detail how this the mathematics of these gerrymandering problems works, since I just touched on. So the basic, there the problem was how to sample, like how to generate good random samples from some from a set of geometric partitions of a shape. For example, that might be a state, and we want to divide that state into, let's say, 10 regions, all of which have roughly equal population, all of which are connected, and maybe we have some additional constraint that the shapes have to be nice in some way, like they can't, maybe the perimeter of the shapes can't be too large or something like that. And so how can I generate a random sample from this? So the basic tool here that gets used for a lot of problems like this is called a Markov chain. And a Markov chain is basically a random walk around any space. So for example, if you're, you know, in a city with a street grid, and you carry out a procedure where you, at every intersection, you roll a four-sided die to decide which direction to walk in. And you keep doing this over and over again so that you're taking a random walk around the city. That random walk that you're carrying out would be a Markov chain on the locations in the city, right? So over time, you would travel around the city. And if you did this for long enough, you would eventually be at an essentially random point of the city. And so the crucial point, the crucial property of a Markov chain, the reason why, so what the name means in mathematics, is that every step, what you decide to do next depends only on where you are and not where you came from. Right, so for example, every time you get to an intersection, you roll a die and you can go in any direction, and it doesn't depend on sort of, you know, what you did 10 steps ago. Okay, and in any case, so a random walk like this can be done not just on a space like city streets, but on any space that you can define. And so what you can do for a problem like the districting problem is define a space which is the set of all possible partitions of the state into 10 regions of roughly equal population, which are nice in shape. So that's a huge space of possibilities, right? So to keep it from being infinite, let's imagine that the districting, the districts, so the partition classes are built out of discrete building blocks. So maybe each one is a collection of voting precincts or something like that.
Right.
So that essentially we're partitioning a planar graph. And how do we define a random walk around this space? Well, you can imagine moving from one districting to another by making a small change to it. Like maybe I find a voting precinct on the boundary of two districts and I change which of those two districts it belongs to. And if I do that, then I've taken one step. I move from one choice of how to partition the state to another. And if I made that choice randomly, so if I had randomly chosen which precinct to change the membership of, then I would have taken a random step in this space.
Right.
And then by making a sequence of steps like this over and over again, I'm walking through this space of possible districts of the state, just like you're walking around the city if you're rolling this die at every intersection. And also just like that, if I do this for long enough, I'll reach what's called a stationary, I'll become close to what's called a stationary distribution, where my location is random, and approximately it's random with a specific distribution that I can calculate.
Right.
And so it lets me get a handle on how to generate these random samples talking about. But there are all sorts of theoretical challenges with using Markov chains in a context like this. So, you know, one thing that I alluded to just now is that if I run this chain for long enough, for example, if I walk around the city for long enough, I'm at an essentially random location. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's true, but what we don't know in many cases is how long you have to do the walk for. So for the city, if I really have something like a square grid, on an example like this, you can prove something about what's called the mixing time, which is how long you have to run the walk before you're essentially random. But for the case of a districting problem, we don't know the mixing time rigorously. And so we don't know how long you have to run. We know that in principle, if I ran it for long enough, I would be in an approximately random state. But we don't actually know exactly how long that would take. And in particular, it could take exponentially long in the size of the state. And so what we do for this problem is we develop statistical techniques that allow us to make rigorous statements about whether districtings are outliers without answering this question of how long you would have to run to mix.
Yeah.
But this question of the mixing time of the chain is itself very interesting. And so this is one thing that we're thinking about now, is what we can say about generating random samples by getting at this question of how long you have to run, you know, through this districting space randomly before you're essentially at a random place. And again, the analogy is, how long do you have to walk around this city until you're at essentially a random place?
Cool. Do you ever spend any time on hard problems, like problems that haven't been solved for a long period of time?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, in some sense, certainly almost everything we work on is problems that haven't been solved. And yeah, sometimes it's problems that haven't been solved for a long time where you think there's a lot of interest. And yeah, I mean, it's important to bounce these problems around. Otherwise, they would never get solved.
Right.
that's definitely something that we thought. Yeah, I mean, it's a balance, right? Sometimes you're thinking about something that, you know, just caught your interest, and sometimes you're thinking about some, you know, big old problem that you've been wanting to solve for a long time.
Nice. What's your Erdős number?
Oh, good question. My Erdős number is 2, I guess. Yeah, so I have a co-author that was a co-author of Erdős.
Nice. For people who don't know, Erdős number is like your degrees of separation from Paul Erdős, who is a prolific mathematician, published like 1,700 papers or something. And if you published a paper with him, your number's 1. And if you've published a paper with someone who published a paper with him, your number's 2, so on and so forth. And that's just something mathematicians brag about.
That's right. Yeah.
Who are some of your who are some of the people you look up to in math, like an idol or a role model?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. So, I think, yeah, so one thing that I think is really impressive is the, you know, big historical advances that were made at a time when our understanding of math was much more in its infancy. So if you think about the sort of the intellectual leaps that were made, for example, by the first discoverers of calculus, somehow, in some sense, what that took, it's not clear that sort of anything that we do now requires as much of an intellectual leap as what happened then, in part because mathematics itself, in some sense, didn't exist, right? We didn't really have a rigorous framework in which we, could develop mathematical theories. And so breakthroughs like that, I think are really quite, I think a lot about these historical examples of, what it took for somebody to break out of, the paradigm they were in. And really get to, generate a lot of insight when there wasn't a good framework for doing that.
Right.
In some sense, now we've built up this this whole intellectual system, which allows us to much more efficiently, develop insight about problems. And I think somehow, the really impressive thing is that we were kind of able to do this before we had that.
Right.
But it was much harder.
How do you foster interest in math among your students or younger mathematicians?
Question. I'm not sure I know the right answer to this. I think what I hope that I do is project excitement about math, and that it's this interesting and fun thing that should captivate us. But I mean, maybe that's a question for you though. Like, what is exciting students today about math?
Well, I think I'm different than most people. I like to state problems. And other people have a lot of trouble with this, but I'll see something on TV or watch a YouTube video, or the canonical example was I was looking at the bathroom tiling, and I was thinking how many ways could you tile an M by M rectangle such that rotations and reflections are the same? And mm-hmm. So that's a story that my friends always tell about me figuring out a problem to solve. So I just see math and everyday stuff, and I'm maybe this is an interesting problem, and some amount of the time it is. Maybe 80% of the time it's either been solved or it's not that interesting, but some of the time it comes up with some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly true for research math also, that the vast majority of problems we work on, we either we don't solve. The joke is, we're failing to solve problems 100% of the time, but 100% isn't exactly right. There's a slight error in that 100%, and that error is where everything happens, right? Every once in a while, we succeed. Yeah.
If you can't solve something and you need someone who you think is, I won't say smarter, but more advanced than you, is there someone specific you like to bounce ideas off of?
So I don't know if most people have a person that they take problems to when they're stuck on. But I mean, there's this thing that we talked about before. Sometimes there's some problem where there's some particular subject matter that you think might be relevant.
Right.
And so. Then you might ask somebody in that field, right? Is there some standard technique for this? Is there? And so certainly people do that, but then who you're asking depends on what kind of what kind of problem you're thinking about.
Would you say your focus is on solving problems or building mathematical theory?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, ideally we're sometimes doing both, but I think for me, somehow, the day-to-day fun of math comes from solving problems.
Right.
But I like to solve problems where, for me, there's some, bigger story about how they fit into, what we're learning about.
Right.
How things work.
Have you been a professor long enough that you've seen some of your students, come and go into the research fields of math as a professor or similar stuff?
Yeah. I have a graduate student who's a faculty member at Auburn University. And yeah, this is the fun thing as a faculty member. You see, yeah, you have graduations come through and then they go on and they have their own careers. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the idea of the book by Paul Erdős?
Yes, I am.
Do you feel like you've written any proofs that would make it into the book?
Ooh, I don't know. I feel like people shouldn't put their own proofs in the book. That's for somebody else to do.
For sure. For those who are listening, the book is an idea by Paul Erdős, and it's like all the world's most beautiful proofs are in there, and mathematicians just, if they're lucky, they get a little glimpse at it, and they get to write it down. And Paul Erdős would say, you don't have to believe in God, but you have to believe in the book.
Yeah, that's right. The idea is that somehow there's this collection of beautiful proofs, and we're trying to find them. It almost reminds me of you know, Michelangelo would supposedly say that he could already, you know, the statue was already in the marble, right? The
right.
Sculpture. And he was just removing the excess marble around it. It was already there. He was just revealing it. So yeah, similar sort of philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have kids?
I do, yeah.
Have you tried to teach some math to your kids, or how have you tried to inspire people with a much younger audience than your students?
Yeah, so I think for kids, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that math comes up, but I mean, one really simple way of, you know, engaging with math with kids is with, you know, various types of games, right? Like
right.
Even tic-tac-toe, right, for young kids is very mathematical, right? It's your first experience with a case study is trying to understand, right? Can I always beat the others in that tic-tac-toe?
Right.
And then there's all sorts of variations you can put in a tic-tac-toe, right? You can try to look at 4x4 tic-tac-toe. Is that the same? What about, you know, higher dimensions, right? You can
right.
draw a few tic-tac-toe boards so that you're really playing on a cube. And yeah, I think that's a fun way of introducing other concepts, you know, introducing sort of mathematical thinking younger kids. I mean, yeah, so at some point a while ago, I taught a program for middle schoolers over the summer. And there, the topic that that I used sort of as this vehicle to explore math was cryptography. So we learned about different encryption methods, you know, matrix ciphers, and and you learn modular arithmetic, and then, you know, you learn public key cryptography, which introduces you to prime numbers and.
Right.
And things like that. And so, yeah, that's a I think a really fun way to engage with medical topics for older kids. Yeah.
Does math run in your family? Like, was your dad interested in math or anyone you looked up to?
I think it's definitely a lot of people can say that, me included, can, you know, look in their family and see some people that had, you know, a lot of interest in math, but I'd say there's also plenty of people that don't have that, sort of at the top of their field, and wouldn't point to any family members that for whom math was an important part of their life. So I think both of these things are really well represented in the.
That makes sense. Yeah. So my dad and grandfather both have a math degree. And so it seems that every like generation has a, like every, I don't know, two or maybe six people, one of them has studied, which is, I think, really bizarre.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's unusual, especially getting that far back in time. Math degrees weren't so common, right?
Yeah, right. So we're a much less famous Bernoulli family. And the Bernoullis were this famous family of mathematicians.
You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WSET or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, PA@WRCT.org. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, in sound, from way out. in my automobile. My baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio. With no particular place to go. Riding along in my
WRCT Pittsburgh. Music for people on the go.
I sent her to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere. And she leaned and whispered in my ear.
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most people have options. Ask your doctor which screening test is right for you. Learn more from the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at getscreened.org.
You're listening to Viva La Mock on WRCT Pittsburgh.
KIX Morning News Update. Mock's promise to rewrite rock history was prematurely and tragically interrupted last night when an overwhelming power surge totally destroyed Carnegie Hall and blacked out the entire city. Survivors described the destruction as evil, spooky, and wow, bad karma, man. Our cameras are on the scene.
My name is Mark Banks of Art. I know you love the thing you've got. You've never seen the likes of me. Why, I'm the biggest thing since World War III, girl. Why, I'm the greatest thing since World War III, girls.
You think he's acting, but he's not. His name is Mark, thanks a lot.
My name is Mark, thanks a lot. I'm the palace I'm used on a lot. I am the pillar, I am the snake. I'm the beat that makes you shake. I am the killer, I am the source. And you will worship me, of course. I'm the oracle, I'm the seer, the wit. There is no question that I am it. Hey, girls.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks a lot. He looks so cool, but he's hot. His name's Mark. Thanks a lot. You think he's acting, but he's not.
My name is Mark. Thanks a lot. My name is Mark.
From his Black Moon Spell album, that's King Tough, here on 88.3 FM WRCT. Before the King Tough, how about some Human Switchboard in that set of music with Who's Landing in My Hangar? Also played some Adam Ant for you. Yeah, went back to Kings of the Wild Frontier for some Ant music to get you dancing. It's a dancing song, is it not? Once you unplug that jukebox, do yourself a favor. Start off the entire set with Lou Reed. Lou Reed from the Rock and Roll soundtrack with My Name is Mock, because indeed my name is Paul, but it's a show called Viva La Mock. So people call me the Mockster. They do. Show comes to each and every week at this hour, and I appreciate you taking some time and listening. How about some Peter Gabriel?
Oh. I want to live where soul meets body, and let the sun wrap its arms all around me and bathe my skin in water cool and cleansing and feel what it's like to be new. Cause in my head there's a Greyhound station where I send my thoughts to far off destinations so they may have a chance of finding a place where they're far more suited than here. Guess what we'll discover. We turn our dirt with our palms cupped like shovels, but I know our filthy hands can wash one another. Not one speck will remain.
I do believe it's true.
There are rules left in both of our shoes. If the silence takes you, then I hope it takes me too. So brown eyes, I'll hold you near. You're the only song I want to hear. A melody softly soaring through my atmosphere. Where soul meets body.
Me. Was I surprised? Yeah. get out of my mind. Had to destroy my old life. I lived it too long. I lived it too long. Had to be sure it's not me. Had to be pure, conscience free. But something is wrong. Something is wrong. Going through the motions.
From their debut album, Keep a Secret, which came out back in 1996, that's the Mysteries of Life here on the Viva La Mach radio program. The song's called Going Through the Motions, and that's what I am. Well, I'm the Machster, and I'm just kind of going through the motions that make up this little radio program I do for you each and every week. Before the Mysteries of Life, from their Live at Town Hall release, Eels with their version of The Left Bank's Pretty Ballerina. Speaking of versions of the Lunar Laugh, put out an album last year, kind of a collection of some songs and some live tracks, and that was a live track of them doing Death Cab for Cutie, Soul Meets Body. Start off the entire set with some Peter Gabriel and Biko. Gets us here, it's 29 minutes, just about 29 minutes past your...
You are listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh, and this is From Ipanema to the World. Thank you.
Welcome to From Ipanema to the World. I am Flavio Chamis. In tonight's program, we have one of the greatest Brazilian modern pianists. It is Caio Pagano. And we have the honor and the pleasure of having Caio as a guest of our program. He is an internationally renowned concert pianist, teacher, and scholar, and has been a professor of piano at the Arizona State University since 1986.